From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. Since late last year, millions of birds have been euthanized across the country as a strain of bird flu has infected chickens and turkeys. The outbreak has been most devastating in Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin since March. That's led officials in all three states to declare states of emergency, while federal officials this week approved an additional $330 million in emergency funds to help contain what is being acknowledged as the worst avian influenza outbreak in U.S. history. Here to talk about the impact on producers and consumers in Wisconsin and Minnesota are UW Extension poultry specialist Ron Keene and Minnesota Turkey Growers Association Executive Director Steve Olson. La Crosse County UW Extension's Mary Meehan Strube talked with them earlier this week about the latest on the bird flu outbreak.
We've kind of been fortunate, I guess, in Wisconsin compared to Minnesota, but we've had 8 breaks here in Wisconsin, 8 different farms. 2 have been fairly large layer operations, so about 1 million hens between those two. 1 small flock of 30 to 40 mixed birds, and then 5 turkey flocks. So altogether, almost 1.5 million birds here.
Steve, what about in Minnesota?
Yeah, our first flock showed up the first part of March, and to date we have 80 flocks. 3 of those flocks are egg layer flocks, the rest are turkey flocks, and that represents about 5.3 million birds that have been either infected directly or euthanized because of the virus.
How do we think that this avian flu outbreak started?
Well, our best guess, and still our strongest theory, is that it's from the wild birds. The fingerprint of the virus that we've seen in Minnesota and in the upper Midwest is the same fingerprint that was found in wild birds in the northwest part of the United States earlier or late last year. And as we watched the migration happen, again, our strongest theory is that as those birds have migrated back to the upper Midwest, they are shedding the virus through fecal matter or through feathers, and that is either getting dragged into the barn on equipment or boots, or we think that it's now attaching to particles of dirt as we've had strong winds this spring, and that those are the ways that the virus is getting into barns.
Are you finding the same is true in Wisconsin, Ron?
That's our theory here. Again, I think there's a little question. We're not sure because we thought it would be in fecal material and biosecurity. We've tried not to allow that in the barns, and yet so now the question is it coming in, on dust particles, as Steve mentioned. But I think everyone pretty well agrees that the wild birds are probably the start.
Where do they acquire this from? I mean, initially, is it because they've become infected from another animal?
Now, this strain is something that's come over from Europe and Asia, and it came over through Siberia, Alaska, and then came down the western flyway, and these birds migrate. Those birds migrate with the birds from the other flyways in Mexico over the wintertime, and so I think that intermingling is what's caused the virus to transfer to the birds that are in the Mississippi flyway.
What happens to the migrating birds? Do they become ill just like those in the confined settings?
For the most part, they don't. They are, they're carriers of this virus, but they don't, some may become sick, some may die, so we're also asking people as they're out and about in wildlife areas to look for dead birds. If they find dead birds, again, to contact the diagnostic labs or the Board of Animal Health or the Department of Agriculture. But for the most part, it doesn't make the birds as ill. It certainly doesn't kill them for the most part, but they are able to carry it and transmit the virus.
Now, when you talked about the number of flocks within each of your states that have this, and of course it looks like Minnesota's considerably larger number of flocks have been affected versus Wisconsin, but it would seem to me, based on the number of birds that you're talking about, is it only major size facilities that are affected?
No, it's been found in Minnesota and then in the Northwest, that it has infected backyard flocks, as well as I think there was a backyard flock down in Kansas. I think why we're seeing it a little bit more predominantly in some of the commercial farms is that the turkeys are a little bit more susceptible to it than chickens are, but also the backyard flocks haven't moved outside as much because of the colder weather. And now that we've got warmer temperatures, I would expect that those will be moving outside. And so that's one of the messages that we have to backyard flock owners is to get information, check out the Extension Service websites and the USDA websites. If there's a backyard for or biosecurity for birds website that's got a lot of great information, and then look for clinical signs in their birds. If the birds are not acting like they normally would, or if they're lethargic, depressed, or if they start to die, then get in to contact the veterinary diagnostic lab in Wisconsin or in Minnesota and get those birds tested to stay ahead of this.
And are we more likely, as we know, when it's a major size facility that's affected, it gets reported, but do we have many reports from the, say, family size, I'll call it family size flock that raises chickens just for eggs for the family, or the individuals who maybe have a bird or two in their backyard? Do we see or have we received many reports from any of those?
Well, again, as Steve mentioned, there's been a few. I think maybe not as many as we would have expected. But I guess my feeling is not that these are happening and they're not being reported. I don't have a sense of that happening, at least in most cases.
Is there a threat to humans that they could be infected with this?
No, there's no threat to humans. As a matter of fact, with the flocks in Minnesota, the Minnesota Board of Animal Health contacts any farm worker that comes in direct contact with those infected flocks, and then they monitor them for a period of time. And in all cases, this is a virus that has not transmitted to humans, and it so far doesn't have that capacity. But that's why we have such a quick response on this. We want to make sure that we lock down this virus and don't let it start adapting, which can potentially cause problems for humans and other birds.
What about other pets and or your family's pets or other animals on farms?
No, this is a virus that shouldn't be a factor for making them ill.
Yeah, there's been, of course, the reports of the canine influenza virus, as you've probably seen around Chicago, and now it's spread to a few other cities. But there's no evidence that those two are really associated. They're different viruses. Even though they're both influenza, they're different viruses, so it shouldn't be a concern.
So right now, what's the best way, if a flock becomes infected, to deal with the avian flu?
What the focus of the commercial poultry farmers has been is to focus on the barn door, try to make sure that virus does not get into the barn door. But even the best biosecurity, the layer farms have some of the best biosecurity we've got out there because they're enclosed. They've got, but the virus has still gotten in there. So the focus has been keeping what's out, keeping what's in the barns, and again, it's through making sure that they are more aware of where their feet have gone to, so they're not dragging something into the barn. And then I think we're also looking at ventilation systems as another biosecurity step that we can increase to reduce the likelihood of virus getting in.
Ron, is the process any different than it would be for any other kind of virus or influenza that would be out there for other animals? Are the procedures the same?
The biosecurity procedures, I would say, are pretty similar. Of course, again, speaking of canine, that's a little different situation because a lot of people are taking theirs out. Or were you speaking of after there's a break?
After there's a break.
Yeah, I would say in that case, in the situation with poultry, our goal is to try to eradicate this virus. And so that's why you see this, total euthanasia of the flock, total depopulation, so that hopefully we can stop that before it spreads to more and more flocks.
When you talk about the euthanasia, what happens to the birds then? Because if you're talking millions, literally millions in both of our states, what happens then?
The most common disposal method for turkeys is in-barn composting. So after those birds are either they die because of the virus or they're euthanized, we use the bedding and the litter that's already in the barns. And the litter contains either wood shavings, oat hull, sunflower hull, something like that. And then pile it all into the middle in windrows in the middle of the barn and then compost it, making sure that it goes through two heat cycles, which are enough to kill the virus. and then that can be land applied after it goes through that process. For layers, it's a little bit more challenging, and they're looking at alternatives. Landfill may be one of the most likely, but we also have a concern about moving product off of a farm, and so we're looking at ways to seal it up and move it off that way.
So it can be composted after the initial period. It's not something that has to necessarily be buried?
Burial is another option, and that's... But again, what we're looking at is at the very least do a partial compost to get through one of those heat cycles, because the virus doesn't survive high temperatures, and so we get a heat cycle of 140 degrees or so. That's well above where it needs to kill that virus, and then it can be buried, or else finish the composting cycle with another heat cycle, and then again it's just like any other compost out there, and become a nutrient source.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio, La Crosse. I'm Mary Meehan Stroob. We're talking about the impact of avian influenza on Wisconsin and Minnesota. Our guests are Minnesota Turkey Growers Association Executive Director Steve Olson and UW Extension Poultry Specialist Ron Keene. When you talk about composting the animals that needed to be euthanized and the volume of birds that you're having or that have had to be dealt with, who pays to destroy the birds?
Any bird that is killed because of the virus, the farmer loses the money on that. There's no insurance available, so they can't insure against a disease loss like this. So they're taking the full brunt of that, again, with any bird that dies because of the virus. What the process is they, the farmers will check their flocks on a regular basis, and most commonly what I'm hearing is that the flock just doesn't seem right. So again, it's lethargic, they're depressed, they're not moving around like they normally would. There's not the same kind of activity. And so that's one indication, and then there's an increase in mortality. And so typically a sample is taken, it's submitted to the veterinary diagnostic labs, and if it comes back as positive, then USDA sends an appraiser out to the farm, and they do an inventory of the live birds, and that's what determines what is eligible for indemnification. Indemnification, basically, it's because USDA will be directing that farm to euthanize or to put down those birds, it's considered a taking. There is indemnification available to help compensate the grower, and it's based on the value of that bird. So it's not something they're going to make money on, but at least it helps to recover some of the costs that they have into that bird, and that's kind of how that process works.
Well, I was just going to add, there's, I think, also a lot of expense because there's a quarantine area and there will be testing of other flocks around that. And so that's where you may have seen some of the reports in the paper about some of the expenses, other reports. So it is quite an expensive process.
Has the bird flu impacted bird populations in the past in Wisconsin and Minnesota?
No. Minnesota's had a history of having avian influenza, but it's always been what we call a low-path kind. So it's a kind that may make the birds sick, but then it's like when you and I get the flu. So it'll slow them down for a couple of days, and then they're fine. Because we've got a lot of water up in the upper Midwest here, and because we have, in Minnesota's case especially, we're home to a brooding area, so that, you know, the wild birds, waterfowl come up here, they hatch their eggs, and then they raise some of their infant birds here. So we tend to see more introductions of it. When we used to raise birds outside, we'd have a lot of introductions of avian influenza. Again, it's the low path kind. But what would happen is that the wild birds and the, in this case, the turkeys would eat. They would feed outside. They'd eat, sit next to each other at the feeder, and then the disease would be transmitted from the wild birds to the domestic turkeys. But 20, 25 years ago, we moved almost all of our production indoors, and that's. We've been better able to control the environment, which a leading outcome result has been that we don't have the same number of introductions of influenza. But the strain that we're seeing right now, this virus, we've never seen. As I talk to people who have been in this industry for 40 or 50 years, they said they've never seen anything like this because of the strength of the virus and the fact that it has such a high mortality with birds when it does infect a flock.
Members of Congress are now pressing for funding to help with the avian flu. What do you think that the federal government can do to help to fight this?
I think the biggest thing is, and I think this is where we're at, is that the Office of Management and Budget is aware of it, and they have released funding. So I think they understand the situation, and they are supportive of what it takes. But ultimately, what we need is the indemnification funds to be available, because this is without those, we would have farmers all across the upper Midwest going out of business. And so those indemnification funds are pretty important. As we move into the next couple of months here and the next year, experts are telling us that this is going to be around for 3 to 5 years, and we expect another wave in the fall. So we are, as we talk to our congressional delegations, we're asking for funding for research, both with USDA's Ag Research Service, but also at the university level, to help us better understand how is this virus transmitted, what's it, you know, to characterize the virus, and then what do we need to do from a biosecurity standpoint. And then we're also having some discussions about some cost share programs similar to EQIP. Maybe it's EQIP, maybe it's something different that will assist farmers in investing in their barn or in their farm to improve the biosecurity. And so maybe it's retrofitting the barn to have tunnel ventilation or just using fans versus the curtains that we have on the sides for a lot of turkey barns. And so those are some of the discussions that we're having with the delegations.
Ron, how much money is needed to fight this in terms of looking at research, and what would it pay for?
Boy, I think any funds are going to be welcome. Certainly, you know, there hasn't been a lot of research in this area. There's been some, but certainly, you know, I think this brings the need home immediately. And so I don't know of a number, but any amount would be helpful.
Steve, you said probably be around for 3 to 5 years, but once we would consider that this crisis is over, will there be debriefings to see if and what can be done to prevent this or deal with it differently in the future?
Yeah, great question. And that's something that we're kind of having some debriefings on a regular basis of what's working well, what's not working well, what would we do differently. And those things are going to be valuable in helping us learn how to deal with this issue, but also any kind of a disease issue, whether it's in cattle or swine or other things. The other thing that's happening as part of this is that the USDA, as part of their response, has a team of epidemiologists that are investigating each one of these infected farms and kind of looking for some common themes. You know, what are there things that exist with this, but they're also controlling it or comparing it to farms that don't have infections, and to see what they can learn for, you know, what the difference is in those cases that may give us an idea of, again, how this disease is being transmitted and what we can do to stop it.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio, La Crosse. I'm Mary Meehan Strube, and we're talking about the impact of avian influenza on Wisconsin and Minnesota. Our guests are Minnesota Turkey Growers Association Executive Director Steve Olson and UW Extension Poultry Specialist Ron Keene. When you talked about the costs earlier, you indicated that for the animals that die, of course, the cost is to the producers. Long term, how will this impact those producers losing the number of birds that you've mentioned earlier?
You know, I think it's a matter of eating away at the equity that they've got invested in their farms. In the upper Midwest, we have a lot of farmers that are second, third, fourth, and even fifth generation poultry farmers. And in order to survive that long, they have to be pretty business savvy. And they know that there's business cycles, and they put money away in the good years, and they have, that's what helps them get them through the bad years. But this is a different ball game. Again, as I've talked to people that have been around the industry for several decades, they say this is something different. And so they're losing equity in their farms, and you know, luckily, most of them have built up the equity, but they can sustain it for a while. But it's gonna take a toll. You know, this is different than anything we've seen in other parts of the country. We did have something out in Pennsylvania in the 80s, but I think what makes this difference is that we're having pinpoint introductions, which means that they haven't been linked by any kind of an ownership. You know, they've got different feed systems, they've got different employees, so there's things that aren't. And sometimes we would see, you know, diseases move from farm to farm. In this case, it's been that pinpoint introduction, which, again, leads us back to that this is some kind of a wild bird introduction. So that makes it a little bit tougher to implement the normal biosecurity measures that we would use in order to prevent a disease introduction.
What about the operations where, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ron, but Are there operations out there that the farmer provides the facility, but the birds and the feed for the birds come from the corporation that owns them?
There's a variety of different systems, and some are contract producers, like you just described. Some are company-owned facilities, so there are a variety of different sort of ownership setup.
Is the impact any worse on any form of ownership?
I think it's certainly damaging to all of them. You know, potentially, as Steve discussed, losing equity, you know, some of the larger companies maybe can withstand that a bit more from flock to flock, but it's certainly a challenge for all of them.
And what about the cost to consumers as a result of what's happening in the, you know, 2015 year now?
Yeah, we don't expect to be any impact on consumers is going to be minimal. Number one is you're looking at the scope of the overall production in the country, and this is still a small percentage of it. And so, and we've lost some export markets because of this, or we haven't been able to ship as much export, so that product will be diverted to the domestic market. So that's a benefit to consumers. And again, we just think that this is not going to have a huge impact for the consumers. And I get asked a question about, well, what about Thanksgiving? It's like there still should be plenty of turkey around at Thanksgiving. And grocers or retailers will use turkey as a loss leader, so they actually sell it to consumers for less than they paid for it, because they're looking at drawing people in to buy the cranberries and the potatoes and everything else that they have for that that holiday meal. And actually, 30% of turkey gets consumed around the holidays of Thanksgiving and Christmas, so a majority of it gets consumed the rest of the year.
What about impact on eggs and chicken as well?
So far, we have not had that. So the broiler chickens, the meat chickens, we've had very little effect. I think there was one or two Canadian flocks that have been affected, although, again, as Steve mentioned, the exports have been affected. So, again, potentially we may have more chicken meat on the domestic market. Eggs, from what I've seen, we're kind of at the borderline with the flocks breaking in Iowa. You know, I think if we see very many more, we could see an effect on egg prices, but currently we're probably still at a manageable level.
Yeah, I would agree with Ron. One of the other hats I wear is of executive director of the Chicken and Egg Association of Minnesota, and so we're watching that too, and I agree with Ron. I think that from an egg standpoint, you know, we are actually, consumer consumption is as high as it's ever been, and prices have been pretty strong too, so that's a good incentive for growers. And again, hopefully we can stay ahead of this, and this won't have any major impact on either eggs or turkeys.
When you talk about exports affected, roughly what percentage of our poultry is exported from the U.S.?
For turkeys, it's about 12% or so. So some of those markets have shut off all of the United States, and they did this last fall. And other markets have limited it to just a state or a region. And even then, they've still allowed product to be shipped if it's going to be further processed. And so the actual impact on imports, or on exports rather, has been somewhat stabilized because of some of those actions. And USDA has worked closely with trading partners to help them understand our response plan and how we're doing it. And I'm drawing a blank on where we're at with eggs and broiler numbers for exports. But, you know, again, most of the broiler operations are in other states, and so that's not being affected as much in eggs. You know, we've got, you know, Minnesota and Iowa and Wisconsin produce a fair number of eggs, but there's still a lot of other egg suppliers in other parts of the country.
Steve Olson is executive director of the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association. Ron Keene is a poultry specialist with UW Extension based in Madison. They spoke with La Crosse County UW Extension's Mary Meehan Strube about the avian influenza outbreak in the upper Midwest. Millions of birds have been euthanized since March in Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up, our conversation about bird flu continues. While there haven't been any reported problems in southeastern Minnesota and southwestern Wisconsin so far, we'll talk with our experts about the regional poultry industry and what producers and communities can do to prevent bird flu. hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share a comment or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. While millions of turkeys and chickens have been put to death as a result of the bird flu outbreak in parts of Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, there have been no reported problems in the greater La Crosse area. La Crosse County UW Extension's Mary Meehan Strube continues her discussion about avian influenza with UW Extension poultry specialist Ron Keene and Minnesota Turkey Growers Association Executive Director Steve Olson. They each talk about the regional poultry industry.
Probably three quarters of the of our production happens in central and mid-central Minnesota, and so the southeast part is, you know, off the top of my head, maybe it's 10% or so, depending on how far we want to find that southeast part of the state. And so it's an important part of the overall production system, but in the scheme of things, it's a little bit smaller than other areas.
And what about southwest Wisconsin, Ron?
We have almost no turkeys there. There's some, but almost all the turkeys are in northwest Wisconsin. Of course, you have a very large broiler production area there, mostly in Trempealeau County. And so, you know, virtually 100% of our broiler production would be in that area. As far as egg production, I would say percentage-wise it's fairly small, but certainly there are a number of small commercial facilities, a lot of organic production in that area, so it's a sizable dollar value.
As we look at the animals that have been affected by the avian influenza, chickens, turkeys, poultry, of all kinds, birds of all kinds, is there a difference in terms of organic versus the traditional or conventional type raising of the poultry? Does it make a difference if it's organic or not?
No, it's not going to make a difference whether it's organic or not. It's a virus that is going to kill flocks, whatever size there are, or whatever type of method of raising. One of the things that organic birds are not outside yet. They typically, at least in Minnesota, they are not raised outside until after the middle of May or so. So we haven't seen that type of exposure, and hopefully this virus has kind of moved through so that would limit any of those from infecting those kind of flocks.
So would the procedure for handling a flock that's infected, whether it's organic or a conventional type raised, would that be different, Ron?
No, it would be handled in the exact same way.
So we've talked about the commercial operations, we've talked about some backyard operations, and also some small farm types of things. How should turkey hunters be responding to this outbreak?
Well, what the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources has done is asked turkey hunters to do two things. One is that if they find dead birds, to notify the DNR so they can take samples. The other is that as they are out there hunting and successfully hunting, to bring in birds to be sampled so they can get a better handle on what's going on in the environment. The DNR in Minnesota has done some wild bird sampling. It's been more of an environmental sample, so they went to certain areas across the state where we've had some infected flocks and sampled bird droppings and feathers. Have not found the virus in there, but that's not surprising because it's kind of after the fact, so we wouldn't expect them to find it. And we're going to have some discussions to look at, you know, what kind of approach do we need to take for this fall to stay ahead of this. And maybe it involves serology, drawing some blood from wild birds to see whether they've been exposed to this virus or not, and use that as hopefully as an early warning system to give us a handle on where things may be at.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm Mary Meehan Strube. We are talking about the impact of avian influenza on Wisconsin and Minnesota. Our guests are Minnesota Turkey Growers Association Executive Director Steve Olson and UW Extension Poultry Specialist Ron Keene. we've talked about turkey hunters. Now, the next thing is we head into the summer season. It's fair season. And at many fairs, we either have small animal barns, we have poultry exhibits. Are they going to be allowed this year?
Well, I can speak for Wisconsin. Thus far, the counties that have been affected, so Jefferson, Juneau, Barron, and Chippewa County, our state veterinarian has put a ban on any events there, shows, swaps, fairs, at least for the present time. Outside of those counties, they are still allowed. A lot of suggestion, you know, to be careful and consider not doing them. I do know that one large poultry show has been canceled that was supposed to be in early June. Some 4-H sort of fun days and things, some of them have been canceled, some have said they're going to continue to have them. So I think what I've been suggesting to a lot of people is sort of a wait and see. You know, if your fair is July, August, we'll see where things are by then. But I don't believe there will be any official limitation on it, except in counties that have had a positive.
Well, a question in regards to if one bird in a flock is infected, does the whole flock become infected? Do they all have to be quarantined?
They do, yeah. And it's, you know, whether it's a commercial flock or it's a backyard flock, that they quarantine the whole flock. And what our experience has been with the commercial flocks is that it's got a very high mortality rate, and so within 5 days that whole flock is dead, and regardless of whether it's, you know, 10 birds or it's 20,000 birds. And so it does move through pretty quickly. And then as part of the response, other flocks that are on that same farm are euthanized because we don't want that virus to get off that farm, even though those birds are healthy. And that's what makes it tough. I mean, this is a financial impact for farmers, but it's also an extreme emotional impact for farm owners and farm workers, because they're watching these birds die from this virus and they can't do anything about it. And then the second factor is that they have to put down healthy birds, and their whole goal and what they've done all their life is try to figure out ways to keep birds healthy. So it's a pretty tough situation for them.
Did I hear you correctly that they die within 5 days?
Yeah, after the infection starts to roll through the flock, pretty much that whole flock has died within about a 5-day period. And one of the clinical signs that commercial farmers are seeing is that the birds, again, they're lethargic. They don't move around as like they normally do. And they will see some elevated mortality. So maybe they'll see 10, 20 birds out of a flock of 10 or 15,000 that are 20,000 that are dead. And then the next day they see, you know, maybe it's closer to 100. And then, you know, by day three, they're talking thousands of birds. And again, there's no way to stop it at this point.
So thinking in terms of, is there another alternative? Could the birds that have not died, with recognizing that there is an infection in this flock, could they be used for food purposes, Ron?
Theoretically, possibly, but it's not something that I would encourage, and it's not something that's allowed. So as soon as that quarantine is placed, there nothing is going to be used for human consumption.
However, does this influenza affect the safety of the eating poultry?
It really doesn't. Again, as I think we mentioned earlier, there's been no evidence of human infection from this. Certainly cooking the product would destroy any virus. But again, the USDA has some good rules in place that they shouldn't get out to the market, but shouldn't be a human issue if by chance they...
Yeah, I think those are great points, because, you know, this is not a food safety issue. That those birds are not going to make it to market. And there are, you know, the way the system works is that there's an infected farm, USDA or the State Board of Animal Health will draw a circle of a 6-mile circle around that farm. And so anything within that 6-mile, that's called a quarantine or a control zone. And then they'll look for and identify any flock of birds in there, whether it's commercial or backyard flocks. They'll go door to door. And then they take samples from those birds to see whether they're infected or not. And for the most part, we're not finding that those other flocks are infected. But in order for those birds to move, because, you know, they're still being fed, they're still growing, and those birds that we need to go to market, we have a testing procedure that's based on science that they will receive a couple of tests within 48 hours and another one within 18 hours of moving. And that test will tell whether they're actively have got the virus. And again, you know, we haven't found that they ever have had that. So then they're moved to market. So again, those are birds that are within that control zone, but they're healthy birds, and it's just a way to help increase likelihood of safe food.
And the eggs are also safe to eat?
They're safe to eat and go through the same kind of a procedure where we're testing those. And with eggs, they're being produced every day. So most farms will have maybe a two-day storage for eggs, and then they need to move off farm because they don't have any more room. But again, there's this testing system that has been developed to make sure that those eggs are free of virus when they get shipped off that farm.
And I want to go back and do a double check. It is not a threat to humans, correct?
Correct. It's not a threat to humans. And the Minnesota Department of Health has been partner in this response all the way through, and actually, you know, way before this. And the other thing, you know, one of the things that the U.S. poultry industry has, we've developed response plans over the last 10 years, and so one of the things that we've done is that every couple of years we will go through an exercise, and it's an exercise that includes all of the poultry industry in Minnesota. We get into a room that's got the Minnesota Board of Animal Health, it has USDA, it has the State Department of Health, and the State Department of Agriculture, and then we go through scenarios. And that's accomplished a couple of things. One is that we're better thought out process for how we respond to the situation that we're dealing with right now. But the second, maybe more importantly, is that you build up a rapport and a relationship with the people in the agencies and with the industry that we're all working together on this, and that's helped our response to this overall crisis.
And as you talk about community or response plans like that, that brings me to the issue of community response. What is it that local communities need to do or should do, recognizing that here in Wisconsin, many of our communities may not have major poultry facilities in their counties. They may have smaller size flocks and maybe only backyard flocks. But is there something in particular that communities should be doing that can initiate or help them to be prepared for this kind of a response?
Yeah, well, number one thing that comes to mind, and I'll let Ron answer this too, but number one thing that comes to mind is keep eating poultry. It's still a good source, and that's one of the things that we are taking every opportunity to let people know that more about what the situation is, how we're responding to it, and the fact that poultry is safe. For those people that have backyard flocks, we're encouraging them to keep a close eye on it. Ideally, if they can keep in a shed, until we get some, you know, another couple of weeks of warmer weather. The warmer temperatures will kill this virus. They don't survive very well in warm temperatures, and the more sunshine we're getting right now is also going to kill the virus. And the third factor in our favor is that wild birds are building up immunity, so they're not shedding the virus as much. But ultimately, anybody that's got backyard flocks, ideally if they could keep them in a shed, reduce that likelihood of them interacting with wild birds. But then keep a close eye. If there's anything that looks different about those, you know, contact the Department of Agriculture or Extension Service in the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, get samples in and stay ahead of it.
So, Ron, I want to go back to community response and kind of preparedness. I think in terms of like business continuity plans and that kind of thing, if there's a disaster, and in some ways this is definitely a disaster, in particular for producers and whatever. So what is it that we need to be prepared for and how?
Well, I think, again, from a poultry standpoint, you know, we should always be hopefully practicing good biosecurity. And as Steve mentioned, watching for issues with the flock. I think just from a disaster preparedness level, again, we have done some of these exercises, certainly with animal emergencies. I know a lot of other city and county officials have done a lot of these, but I think they really do work well, and again, just that communication and knowing who you're working with different groups, you know, they're good exercises, and I think anytime you can do one of those, it helps to prepare. And certainly you're going to be surprised by a few things, but you know, who to call and who's going to be working on different things. I think they've been really valuable in preparing us as well as we have.
Mary, if I can add one more thing, is that, you know, there's a, farms support a lot of businesses within rural communities, and so it's electrician, it's plumbers, it's feed companies, and I think it's important for all of those to understand that, first of all, farms are not letting some of those vendors out if they don't need to be out there, because, again, it's another risk to their biosecurity. But when they do need to go out, to make sure they follow, they contact that farmer, they find out what the biosecurity procedures are. Typically, it's making sure that within a couple day, 2-3 day period, that they're not on any kind of a poultry or swine farm ahead of that, because they could bring something on. And when they do come on, make sure that they're washing their tires, disinfecting their tires and wheel wells before they enter that property and when they leave that property, and also to get a car wash again before they come onto that property and when after they leave that property, to make sure they're not bringing something down the road that could come onto any particular farm.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio, La Crosse. I'm Mary Nienstrub, and we're talking about the impact of avian influenza on Wisconsin and Minnesota. Our guests are Minnesota Turkey Growers Association Executive Director Steve Olson and UW Extension Poultry Specialist Ron Keen. Well, we're heading into hopefully warmer weather, so will the warm weather that comes with summer take care of this avian flu?
It should. It's one of those things that the avian health experts are telling us, is that you know, we get that this virus doesn't survive very well, especially once we start getting above 70 degrees, and hopefully we've got a good week or so here of 70 degrees coming. And then the ultraviolet light from the sunlight kills it, and then finally the birds themselves are building up immunity, and they won't be shedding the virus as much into the environment.
So then, Ron, will it return again in the fall, do you think?
Well, we're afraid of that. Again, I think, you know, there's been some experts saying that probably 2 to 3 to 5 years of this we might have, as it takes a while to sort of cycle through some of the wild bird populations and let them build up immunity. So it may be a spring and a fall situation for a couple of years anyway.
So as I listened to both of you talk today, and this is a major issue for poultry producers in our two states as well as several other surrounding states, but it can affect humans at the current time. It isn't transferable to other animals. So the major issue is the impact it has on those farmers and the farm workers, a potential for financial impact within the community, and then also there's the fear factor or paranoia that's out there for people being concerned about eating poultry products. What is it that needs to be done to help address that issue as well?
I think the best thing is just keep getting the message out that this is not a food safety issue, nor is it a human health issue. And that, again, that, you know, poultry that has the virus in it is not getting to the consumer market or to the processing plant. So it won't hit that consumer market. And then ultimately, you know, another thing, this is an opportunity to talk, is people go into the grilling season this year. One thing we are always, even if this wasn't an issue right now, we'd always be telling people, make sure you cook your poultry properly, hit that 165 degree, and that's the same with any kind of a meat. And then also make sure that you keep poultry and raw meat separate from other food products in the refrigerator.
And Ron, in your work with extension educators out in the counties, what is it that you're suggesting that they do as they work with not only farmers but people in their communities?
Yeah, I know I've worked a lot with the county agents, and, you know, again, stressing biosecurity, stressing sort of these, I'll say them old things, but, you know, cleanliness, disinfecting, not bringing diseases home with you, not spreading diseases around. I know a lot of the county agents have worked with some of the farm stores and feed stores, spreading information that way so that they're getting that information out to a lot of the growers. And I think they've also worked with their local media, as you have, you know, spreading this information so that the correct information is out there.
So if avian influenza lasts 3 to 5 years, can the poultry industry withstand that? Ron, I'll let you go first.
I think the industry can. Certainly, you know, individual producers are going to struggle with that. But I think, you know, we'll make it through, but it may be some lean years.
And Steve, what's the response in terms of the Turkey Association?
You know, I would agree with Ron's comment, too, that I think that, you know, the industry will survive. And my hope is that we don't lose anybody because of this from a financial standpoint. There are some guys that are probably getting close to retirement, and if they need to make an investment in their building, they may say, you know what, I'm not going to be able to recoup that investment in that period of time, so they may not do it. But I think the key to that is to that surviving and to getting ahead of this is going to be research. And so just in general, we need more research in agriculture anyway, because the research that we're doing today will help us solve problems 20 years from now. And so that's an investment in the security of our food supply. And so, you know, more research needs to happen anyway, but specifically with this virus, we need to better understand it and figure out, you know, how to stay ahead of it as it may change over the next couple of years.
And so a recap on biosecurity types of things that people should be aware of, not only from the standpoint of if they are an ag producer, for people coming to their farm, or for people that are visiting farms, what are the precautions that need to be taken?
The number one recommendation that we've got for people is that for farms is to you know, limit the number of people that come onto that farm, and be more aware of where, you know, whether it's a farm worker where they have been, or if they've got somebody coming onto the farm, make sure that they are aware of where they've been. That they don't come from a wildlife area. They don't come from hunting. They don't come from an area where they're likely to drag it in. And one of the things that we talked a little bit about the fairs. In Minnesota, we haven't stopped any fairs yet. I think we're going to see how this plays out over the next few weeks here. But one of the things that is being stopped is that there are poultry swap meets where people that raise poultry will get together and they'll trade birds or they'll buy and sell birds. And you know, especially those in a control zone where there's a high density of poultry or there's infected cases, the State Board of Animal Health has put a stop to those for the time being.
And sanitation-wise, Ron, what's needed?
Yeah, and again, I guess since there are a lot more people with small flocks, you know, things like changing boots or wearing plastic boots, disinfecting your boots before you come in. You know, I think some people may feel that since their life doesn't depend on those flocks, you know, they can ignore some things. You know, not borrowing equipment. Don't borrow crates from somebody else that might transmit the disease. Just some little things there, you know, that can really go a long way.
When we initially started talking, we talked about how the virus is being transferred through particles of dust. And so should we be recommending to the backyard flock producers that they should be bringing their animals inside as well?
Yes, I think we should. And I think, you know, in general, they are more secure. There's less exposure there. And yet, I think we haven't seen quite the breaks that we would expect. And maybe it is, as Steve mentioned earlier, that birds haven't been out a whole lot yet. I think, again, this is an area where we need some research to really know for sure.
Ron Keene is a poultry specialist for UW Extension in Madison. Steve Olson is executive director of the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association. They spoke with La Crosse County UW Extension's Mary Meehan Strube about an avian influenza outbreak that has affected millions of turkeys and chickens in Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. In recent weeks, that's led to states of emergency being declared in all three states. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Stroub, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share a comment or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.